Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with Mr. Patrick Garrity. Patrick, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. I'm in Michigan, and it's fall, and it's still warm out, so things are doing great.
Excellent, excellent. Thank you so much for coming on. And folks, if you're enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, review, all the things. It really helps me out. Thanks in advance. So Patrick, tell us about yourself. Tell us about your background and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, so a little over a decade ago, I made a shift from working in IT and in managed service providers, and mostly on the sales side with some hands-on implementation. But I got the opportunity to join a security company, Duo Security. And that was my start in really pure play, you know, building security companies. So went on and did that with multi-factor authentication, which was a big market shift. Most people weren't adopting MFA back then. Most people are now. There's still a lot of people that haven't, which kind of explains long market cycles. And then as I was there, we got acquired by Cisco. I helped a company called Census spin out of the University of Michigan. And that was on the tech service management side. And then I decided to leave Cisco after a few years and join an early stage startup called Blumira. And we were focused on small business detection response. So a SIM where you didn't have to configure all the rules yourself. And all that work was done for you. And then more recently, about a year and a half ago, I got introduced to the founders at Nucleus Security and the space of vulnerability management, which everyone at the time thought was super boring. Was like, oh, wow, like it is boring. Nobody's done anything innovative or disruptive. Huge opportunity with market shifts where it looked like the right place to be, right time. So I decided to join the ranks in vulnerability management.
Where would you say the current state of vulnerability management is and then where it's going?
I kind of laugh, right? Because for most organizations, like they're getting caught in a situation that they didn't plan for. So it's a disaster. And maybe that's an extreme word, but like I talk to vulnerability management teams all day long and everyone is struggling with the large amount of vulnerabilities that are out there, the disparate amount of information and data, the new threats that are out there, right? The new exploits, like all the new threat intelligence. If you look back in 2020, there wasn't even a really much of any public sources for threat intelligence. There was some, I think ExploitDB maybe, or VulnDB, I'm probably mixing my databases up. You have Metasploit and some other tools, but like nobody really cared about exploitation information like they do today. And the reason why was there really wasn't much initial access happening through exploits. Like normally exploits would be used once someone gets in your environment to move laterally, but it really wasn't used like it is today to get initial compromise into systems. And probably the biggest thing data point I try and share with people is it's like 2020 Mandiant is like the definitive source of breach data, right? They're one of them. I know other companies have their own views and opinions, but they were like phishing, credential compromise. That was it for the last decade. And we foresee that in 2022 or 2023, their report is like the initial attack vector is suddenly exploitation of vulnerability. So it changed overnight. And so you see the exponential growth in vulnerabilities. You see the exponential growth in exploited vulnerabilities. You see the exponential growth in proof of concepts on GitHub and other places. And like you have access now where anybody can go to a Shodan or a Census and frankly get information of what's vulnerable without much of any work. And so I think that's what we've seen change so rapidly and quickly. And now organizations are trying to figure out how to adapt and respond to that situation that they're in.
Probably most have a vulnerability scanner. It's like, this is great. We have all of this huge list of vulnerabilities
in a CSV or Excel file, right?
Yeah, a nightmare. And it's thousands of lines long. It's awful. What are some lessons learned from your perspective on vulnerability scanners in general?
One I would say is most larger enterprise organizations have more than one in their environment. And there's a change where you have the network scanners, right? So that might be like a Qualys, Rapid7, OpenVAS, Tenable, Nessus. And then you have evolution of more agent-based or your EDRs now even collecting vuln information. That's one piece of the pie. And then you have application scanners, right? So that's another piece of the pie. So that's like your Invicti, your GitHubs, your Snakes, your code repositories. There's just all this vuln data that people didn't have access to in asset data. So part of it is like, none of these are definitive sources. I can tell you when I scan with a Tenable, I'm going to see something different than Qualys. I might scan with two different Tenable products and see different things, right? And then there's also information within these scans that, so I think the pervasiveness among the data is like, yes, the more scanning that you do, there's going to be more data. There's going to be different perspectives depending on where that scanner is located, what scanner is using, is it agent-based, is it not? And then the types of scanners, right? And what's being used and what's actually being scanned. I guess we could throw cloud scanners in there too, OT scanners. We could probably go on. There's hundreds of different assets that you could scan in different ways that you could scan there.
So let's shift in then to these risk assessment methodologies that we have. Starting with CVSS, and I suppose we can start with the criticisms, but I also understand there's been a new version, version 4, that just came out. So interested to hear first criticisms, and then let's talk about version 4.
Well, first I want to promote a little bit with CVSS, the Common Vulnerability Scoring System. It's managed by Special Interest Group on first.org, and there is a training there. I took it actually last night, and it's an hour-long training on CVSS version 4. Highly suggest checking out. I think you have to just sign up for first.org to get access to that. And it's informational. It's good. The thing that is challenging in criticisms of CVSS, fundamentally, most organizations interpret the Common Vulnerability Scoring System as the base score. Mm-hmm. And the base score is what CVSS generates and provides based on only the vulnerability itself. And then that goes through into the National Vulnerability Database. And that's what all these vulnerability management tools then ingest into their products. And so the challenge with that is that most organizations that have standardized in the compliance frameworks on CVSS, they've standardized on this base score, which is highly inflated, assuming a worst case scenario that everything is being exploited in the wild. And so fundamentally, it's like, well, if you assume worst case scenario for everything, then you have to fix everything. So the scoring system has been incredibly challenging if you don't enrich it in order to get what they call temporal scoring. Yes. And I think that the temporal scoring incorporates threat, but it's still in CVSS versions 3.1, like it's very hard to understand and use. And so that's the criticism part, but I think we need to acknowledge, like, people haven't even been using CVSS in the right way historically. And so they came out with these new nomenclatures with version 4, and they changed the threat metric to be much more understandable and easy to assign. And so the nomenclatures include the base score is one score, then you have the BT score, which is base plus threat. So that's where you enrich. Now, at the same time, the end user is responsible for the enrichment. So it's my belief that until vulnerability management vendors do the enrichment at scale for customers, BT scores are only really going to be useful for the most sophisticated vulnerability management programs in the world. So I think, like, that's going to be upon ourselves to help the community by doing things like auto enrichment for them. Because reality is most vulnerability management teams don't have the expertise, knowledge, or time to correlate threat intelligence and do that themselves.
That's very interesting. And I have some thoughts here too. I submitted two CVEs, maybe a year ago or something like that. It was on WordPress plugins. And it was an interesting experience, but also there's incentivization from the independent security researcher to make the CVSS as high as possible, just so that they can say, wow, I got like a 10 out of 10. This is a big one. You should really cover this, you know?
I never thought of that. Yeah. Well, I think there's that, but then also you have vendors that are submitting them, and vendors probably want them to be lower, maybe. And so, yeah, there's definitely, I think, some with any self-assessment, right? There's like some conflicts of interest. One other thing I want to add with CVSS version 4 is you also have to keep in mind that nobody's going back and rescoring all the 240,000 vulnerabilities that exist. And only right now are we initially starting to get scoring. NVD is not scoring CVSS version 4 right now, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to keep in mind that we are on a long time horizon until CVSS version 4 is even something that organizations can adopt or standardize on, because, like, there's still a long tail of NVD vendor adoption and so on and so forth. And then also it only applies to new vulnerabilities, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, we're still going to be using CVSS version 3.1. And in some cases on really old vulnerabilities that never got rescored, CVSS version 3 or 2. And so that's the reality, is it's like CVSS in using the scoring system is a bit of a Frankenstein. And that's not meant to be a criticism, but like, who has the resources and time to go rescore 240,000 vulnerabilities? I do think that like there are some interesting ways where like the team at Scientia has like built rescoring for 3.1 so that they could enrich the exploit prediction scoring system, which we can talk as well. But yeah, the reality is like, I think it's exciting that we're seeing progress and momentum on these open standards. And I think the CVSS version 4 BT and BTE score could be really promising, but like, yeah, we're a while away from where that could be on the customer side. We're probably talking 1 to 2 years if we're being realistic about things. And same thing with the KEV, like nobody was adopting the KEV when it was released in 2021. We're now 2 years later and like people are finally have taken a pass at it. And so I think like we just have to be realistic around how long, you know, these adoption life cycles actually happen with open standards and technology.
Yeah, this is very interesting and shifts right into the threat intelligence piece. Can you talk to us about the exploit prediction scoring system?
Yeah, so I'm a big fan. I'm heavily involved in EPSS, the exploit prediction scoring system. I got involved out of curiosity. And when I first came across it, I was like, hey, this thing isn't perfect. I think everyone in vulnerability management, the first thing they knew is there's, because like they've been dealing with the CVSS base score that like 60% of things are critical and high, maybe 56%, yeah. Right? So you're a skeptic, right? Oh, hey, exploit prediction scoring system, this score is low, but there's known exploitation, right? Why is that? Well, what the exploit prediction scoring system does is it basically is a machine learning model that is fed data, PE data, right? And they have different sources for exploitation. And they take all the metrics. So they actually take CVSS metrics. They take information about the vulnerability, what products they are, what vendors they are, what CWEs they are. We can go on and on. Like, I think there's probably 1,000 different attributes. Like, is this seen in a GitHub repository? Is there a proof of concept on GitHub? Mm-hmm. Is there a Metasploit module? And then they have data sources that have confirmed exploitation, like Fortinet, F5, Gray Noise, bunch of other ones. Sorry, I should probably pull up and make sure mention everyone. A shadow server. And basically, it then uses this information to determine the calculation between 0 and 1. And when we're talking about between 0 and 1, we're talking about decimals, right? And that is a percentage probability that exploit would be exploited over the next 30 days. That's different. Whether something's going to be exploited in the next 30 days is different than if it has been exploited in the past. Mm-hmm. So there's a really important thing to note with EPSS is like, it's not a silver bullet. You shouldn't use it by yourself. Like, you should still use confirmed threat intelligence on what has been exploited. So a good mm-hmm. example of that would be CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities list, the KEV. Mm-hmm. But before we hop into there, it's like, the scoring system is a very high indicator on when a score is a higher probability that there's likely going to be exploitation in the next 30 days. And it's calculating that based on the attributes it's seen in exploitation. Mm-hmm. And so if you take, for instance, 100 vulnerabilities that have a 0-1 score or 1% probability, one out of 100 of those vulnerabilities are likely to be exploited in the next 30 days. And it's a pretty accurate model when they measure it and look back on it based on real intelligence. But there's some bias in it too. Like, it's biased towards network vulnerabilities. There's still value in application vulnerabilities as well. But those are the things that, like, it is very effective at finding some high-risk vulnerabilities in the needles in the haystack. That's why I'm a big advocate, because CVSS base score is the most widely adopted scoring system, and it doesn't even consider threat. So right. EAP's now becoming the second most widely open standard adopted scoring system, but it incorporates threat. So like, that's moving the needle further from an organizational perspective and helping people prioritize things that have real threat risk associated with them.
Interesting. Are we starting to see vulnerability scanners also leverage EPSS?
Yeah. So I think that some of them are obfuscating it. And so I think there's a balance. you know, when we talk about adoption of EPSS, there's a few different things. And not just scanners, anything with volume data, we're seeing EPSS adoption. So we look at companies like Wiz have adopted, I think Fortinet, and there's PurePlay where they provide an EPSS score. And then there's other ones like Qualys, for instance, has their true risk score. And they use EPSS as a component of that risk score, but they don't expose EPSS externally. So there's some differences as far as how it's being used. And then there's also like Mandiant, they use EPSS with their commercial threat intelligence team, and they'll actually use it to then do human analysis on the vulnerabilities to say, okay, EPSS is saying something's going on here. And they do that with a bunch of different sources. Like, why is that? Let me go do human analysis and research to figure out like what's changed. And now we can have human analysis in complementary. And that's one of the big values of commercial threat intelligence with something like EPSS, right?
And now a quick word from our sponsor, Keeper Security.
Handling controlled unclassified information, CUI, is pivotal for DoD contractors. But defense industrial base organizations face challenges in returning CUI to agencies efficiently. Currently, sharing CUI is done mainly through Microsoft encrypted email or by creating encrypted PDFs with passwords sent separately. These methods often fail due to strict internal controls on government machines and the complexity for non-technical users, hindering effective communication. Keeper's FedRAMP authorized file sharing capabilities offer a seamless way to share encrypted files without the need for recipients to log in or have a license, ensuring compliance and ease of use. With Keeper, not only can you track all file sharing activities, but you can also enable real-time security alerts. For DIB organizations moving towards stricter IT controls, Keeper not only mitigates the need for numerous passwords, but also presents a compelling case for broader licensing, aligning with budget considerations for encrypted file sharing under CMMC. Embrace Keeper's encrypted file sharing solution to streamline your CMMC compliance process, enhance security, and unlock additional budget for your organization. Visit KeeperSecurity.com to get started today.
You'd mentioned CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities catalog. Talk to us about that.
It's really fascinating. The Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency had all this exploit information across agencies, and it had been building it internally for a while. In 2021, there was a CISA bot, a bidirectional operative, from the government 2201 that basically was focused on civilian agencies and reducing the significant risk of non-exploited vulnerabilities. And this is one of the shifts where I talked about earlier from risk assessment to actually action or vulnerability assessment and shifting to vulnerability management and risk-based vulnerability management. So this list is basically over 1,000 vulnerabilities, maybe 1,100 now. And it's known vulnerabilities that have been exploited in the wild, confirmed by one of the most definitive sources of intel, the U.S. government. And the great thing is CISA decided not only to give this to federal agencies, but make it public so everyone in the world has access to it. And so that has been a open source intelligence source for vulnerability exploitation. It's not perfect. It's not the most pervasive, but like that's a good aspect of somewhere to start is the known exploited vulnerabilities list. And then maybe once you get all those fixed, you could then go to EPS and look at all the high probability scores. And I say high with EPSS, that's really going to be interpretive based on the organization's risk, right? So like I mentioned earlier, a score of like 90% would mean 9 out of 10 of those vulnerabilities would be exploited. So you could set a score probably much lower than that, but you can increment once you go through something like the CAD and then move over to EPSS if you're going to prioritize based on threat over just the fundamental vulnerability itself.
Interesting.
So CISA-CEV's pretty cool. I find it interesting. One thing I think people had a lot of criticisms of it early on, that it was just a pile of old vulnerabilities. And that has changed overnight. One thing I would say that CISA maybe doesn't do as well is it takes a while for vulnerabilities to get on the list. So if you look at commercial threat intelligence feeds, if like timing is really important to understanding exploitation, like commercial threat intelligence is going to be really fast at getting information regarding exploitation, where mm-hmm. Kev is a little bit more of like, they're going to add something. There has to be a patch available. There's certain criteria, but it's going to be a slower process, right? Mm-hmm. And they've gotten better about that. But I think that's a real reality where it's like, it's good, but it's more of an audit function as well. So they're continuing to improve it and it gets better and better. And if you look at the last year, most of the vulnerabilities fall within the last 2 or 3 years, which kind of demonstrate like they're not just looking at vulnerabilities from 2012 or 2013.
Interesting. Now, is there any automation capabilities with Kev? Do they have an API that a tool could integrate with?
Yeah, so they have an API and it's essentially like a JSON file or a CSV file, right? And so in Excel, you can import in Excel, you can play around with it and look at it. And that's actually where I've done a lot of my work on the data visualization side is like, I look at the data, I slice it different ways. Actually, in my background, I have over here the known exploited vulnerabilities catalog data visualization. Like, this yeah. was sliced up between companies, right? And the number of vulnerabilities associated with them. So, but there's definitely some biases, like the US government is going to be more infrastructure oriented in the CAB. They have a lot of different technologies, but Microsoft is very pervasive. So there's a lot more Microsoft vulns and there's a lot of old Microsoft vulns, right? So those are some of the things I look at. And then one of the things I think recently they added that's pretty cool is they just added whether there's a ransomware actor associated with the vulnerability, which like if you see that, that should give you a sense of urgency to fix something really fast and quick, both on the external side, but also like if someone's using an exploit for ransomware, you probably want to patch it internally because they're likely to use it to live off the land and move around within your environment as well. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the different ways people can think about how to use the SysaKev known exploited vulnerabilities catalog.
Now, vulnerabilities and vulnerability management definitely has national security implications. You hear a lot about the power grid and industrial control systems. Can you talk to us about those concerns?
Yeah, I have huge national security concerns. And I think everyone should. Even, I think 60 Minutes a week and a half ago, you had like Five Eyes, which is the intel organizations from the top English speaking countries, I think Canada, US, UK, Australia, New Zealand, something of that nature, talking about heightened awareness in general too. Regardless of whether you're a federal agency or not, in anywhere in the world, right? You have to realize that like vulnerability, exploitation, ransomware, and these attacks fundamentally are attacks on democracy. And I say that because it's like you look at the threat actors associated with what's going on. Mm-hmm. Predominantly where we're seeing these attacks come from is China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And so not only are they looking to steal intellectual property, not only are they looking to infiltrate the government, but the reality is they also have a heavy interest in stealing money and creating inconveniences within our society. And so, you know, I look at it, it's like, well, you look at some of these recent incidences, Clorox is a good example. The ransomware gang is, I think today they said is filing the SEC complaint. It's like, oh my gosh, like this is insanity. But, and I don't know who, like, I don't know the details on who's associated with a threat actor. You look at MGM, same thing, but like, these are societal disruptions. This is in the interest of the Chinese government. This is in the interest of Russian government. This is like, they want this inconvenience to happen. And it is a war. Maybe they're not coming with a rocket to the US, but the reality is they took down these viable, great businesses and they did it in a way through technology and through extortion and through cybersecurity. So I think like, not only do we have to be mindful of national security as a federal agency perspective or a government perspective, mm-hmm. it's like, it's everyone's responsibility across the board to really take a stance in take things seriously and enforcing some of the most basic controls, vulnerability management, patching KEVs, implementing hardened MFA, working on their misconfigurations. And we could go on, but yeah, from my perspective, like the data shows, it's like we're in a cyber warfare constantly and it's across the board in regards to where we're seeing the attacks happen as we read on these reports continually.
At a conference I was at ICS Miami, which was all about industrial control system, OT security, there was a gentleman who spoke in the context of healthcare. And he was talking about how healthcare facilities have very, very specific parameters for their, I think, HVAC systems in order to keep humidities at certain levels. And if the humidity increases above a certain level, it can increase the chance of infection. And then there was another negative consequence at a low humidity. So there are so many considerations when it comes to the OT space. It's just unbelievable. I completely agree with you. This has been really fascinating, very, very informative. I really appreciate you coming on and talking about these things. Do you have any closing thoughts or anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think take a step back. Vulnerability management can be incredibly overwhelming, especially in large enterprise, lots of data. I always tell people, like, try and start small and increment. Start with a single source, apply something like KEV or EPSS, start aggregating your data in some way, and reiterate and figure out how to get alignment with other parts of the organization. Cause like, you do need to ensure that you're pushing out and collaborating with other organizations and in defining what success looks like with vulnerability management. So yeah, I would say like, start with the things you have access to, the things you can control, increment and build and grow accordingly. And that's going to help a lot from a success perspective and making sure that you're getting alignment with key stakeholders and leadership. So not really any silver bullets. Be careful of silver bullet promises. A lot of times people get misled or misunderstand things. And so spend the time to understand the different technologies, become familiar. And that's some of what I try and do is educate people on these different topics in general. So yeah, that's my best advice. And I appreciate you having me on today, Jacob.
You're so welcome. Where can people find you?
LinkedIn's the best place, Patrick M. Garrity. And if you look at my featured section, there's a ton of my data visualizations and the research that I did, which is pretty fun to look through.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.